I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we'll begin by taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Present.
I believe Representative Bierman is excused. Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo. Representative Igo. Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert, present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
I believe Representative Mecklen is also excused. Representative Munson.
Munson, present.
And Representative Stevenson.
Present.
A quorum is present. We have three bills that we will be doing informational hearings on today. And the first bill is Representative Akam's bill, the Next Generation Climate Act. Representative Akam, welcome to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity for an informational hearing on the Next Generation Climate Act. This bill is an update to the bipartisan Next Generation Energy Act of 2007, which for the first time established greenhouse gas emissions reductions that were based on the best science of that time. Today, 14 years later, the science tells us we need to update those targets and that we must have net zero carbon emissions by 2050 in order to prevent the worst impacts of the climate crisis. We have heard several scientific experts in this committee tell us that unless we dramatically reduce our carbon emissions, many of the symbols and traditions we associate with our state may disappear. While it may not feel like it today, our state is the fastest warming state in the country. This warming is impacting the viability and range of our state bird, the common loon, our state fish, the walleye, and our state tree, the red pine. We have heard about our changing climate being threatened and jobs and livelihoods of Minnesotans who work in agriculture and logging. We have heard about the growing health impacts of climate change, particularly on our communities of color and low income. But the future doesn't have to be that way. We have the tools we need to dramatically reduce carbon emissions. The Next Generation Climate Act sets the targets we need to achieve in order to prevent the worst impacts of climate change. Young people today look to those of us in leadership positions because we literally have their future in our hands. The time to act is now to ensure their future is bright. I have some testifiers who will be presenting this morning, and first up is Dr. Roop, a professor of climate science from the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Roop. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chairman Long and Vice Chair Akam and members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee for the opportunity to join you this morning. I am Dr. Heidi Roop, an assistant professor of climate science and an extension specialist at the University of Minnesota. I work on various aspects of climate science and climate preparedness, and I'm here today to provide you with the scientific basis for the urgent need for significant reductions in global greenhouse gas emissions. In my research career, I've spent over a decade collecting and generating records of past climate variability, including ice cores from Antarctica. And the reason I mention that in the context of this hearing is that it's from the ice core record that we have direct evidence that our atmosphere today is markedly different than the atmosphere of the past. In 2019, the global average concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide was around 410 parts per million. The ice core record, which goes back over 800,000 years, shows us that this is higher than at any point in that record. If we look to other geologic records, they suggest that the last time atmospheric carbon dioxide was this high was likely more than 3 million years ago, and temperatures are around 3.5 to 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the pre-industrial era, which is around 1890 to the 1900s. So the driver today, however, in these changes is us, and the opportunity for remarkable transformation to a different future for our environment and our society is also ours. The urgency to reduce emissions and prepare for the impacts of warming have never been greater. As my remarks today will highlight, the window of time for limiting warming to the policy targets agreed to under the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015 continue to narrow with each and every day that passes. Our efforts to both reduce emissions and prepare for climate change are already occurring here in Minnesota, across the nation, and the globe, but all of these actions must be rapidly scaled up in order to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations and adequately prepare our state and nation for the changes underway. In essence, there is no time to waste. The Paris Climate Agreement committed to limit warming well below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and to pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. In 2018, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was charged with releasing a special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, and was charged with describing the state of the science on the expected impacts between 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming and 2 degrees of warming, and further to outline global greenhouse gas emissions pathways. So how can we get there? How do we achieve these global targets? My remarks today are built primarily around this report, the fourth US National Climate Assessment, and subsequent reports that I've co-authored. My take homes for you today in these brief remarks are, first, we're close to locking in 2.7 degrees of warming. The costs and negative consequences associated with each additional amount of warming are significant. And at current rates of emissions, we will exceed these targets within the lifetime of most of us alive today. That means many of us on this call and your constituents stand to lose in the future from our choices today. And of course, the burdens of these impacts are not equally distributed around the globe, nor here in Minnesota. The choice is ours, and our collective future depends on climate-informed decisions and climate leadership today. Warming resulting from continued emissions of greenhouse gases is adding, on average, around 0.5 degree of Fahrenheit to global average temperature each decade. Our planet is warming, and so is our state. You've seen these data, I'm sure, in other presentations, but the globe is warming, and as Representative Akam has already articulated, we're seeing warming already in our state, and we're one of the fastest growing warming states in the country. This warming translates into real world impacts on our landscapes and in our communities and on our health, and this occurs through a range of impacts like flooding and extreme precipitation. If current rates of warming continue, we are on target to reach this 2.7 degree or 1.5 degree C target as soon as 2030. This plot is showing global average temperature change relative to the pre-industrial period with observed warming in blue. So this is human-induced warming, and an extrapolation of the line should we continue on our current emissions pathway. If the rate of current warming continues, global average warming is likely to reach that 2.7 degree target somewhere between 2030 and 2052. Again, this is within the lifetime of most people on Earth today. Further, with every additional amount of warming, the costs and challenges of climate impacts increase. These data show a few examples of the meaningful difference that just 0.5 degree of Celsius of temperature change can make. Billions more people exposed to heat wave around the globe, a doubling of losses to the US GDP, increased crop losses, worsening water scarcity issues, and negative effects on human health. Additional emissions commit us to increasingly severe global and local impacts. Once we emit, we commit. Apologies again. Our actions today largely determine the extent and magnitude of these changes. This plot from the fourth National Climate Assessment shows observed changes in temperature in green since 1900, with different projected changes in temperature based on high and low emissions pathways. The high is in red, the blue is in low. We're currently following the red trajectory. And while there's inherent uncertainty in what the future holds, the greatest source of uncertainty and potential change in global temperature, that is where we end up on these curves, is human behavior. We can capture the physics of Earth's climate system pretty well in our climate models. However, we don't have the same skill in predicting human behavior, even though that's the largest determinant of future global climate change. global CO2 emissions need to fall to net zero by mid-century to avoid this 2.7 degree Fahrenheit target. In many cases, we are on track to overshoot that target and we can bend the curve back down. But net zero emissions occurs basically when the amount of CO2 entering the atmosphere is matched by the amount that we remove. So as long as we add more to the atmosphere than is being removed, as is currently the case, global temperatures will continue to increase. Limiting warming to that 2.7 degree Fahrenheit threshold implies reaching net zero CO2 emissions globally around 2050 and concurrent deep reductions in emissions of other greenhouse gases, particularly methane. Fortunately, many paths can get us there, but time is of the essence. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change provides multiple alternative global greenhouse gas emissions reductions pathways, as represented by these various squiggles on this plot, looking out into the future. All of these would limit global warming to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, but they all share certain features, including steep near-term reductions in emissions and energy demand, the achieving of net zero by 2050, decarbonization of electricity and other fuels, electrification of energy end use, deep reductions in agricultural emissions, and some form of carbon dioxide removal through carbon storage on land and sequestration in geologic reserves. It's important to note that those carbon capturing technologies have not yet been proven at scale. And so that's a significant challenge that we face, and that all of these features require that sequestration of carbon. All of these pathways require rapid transformation in our economic sector, including buildings, industry, transport, energy, agriculture, and forestry. So while we have options in a multitude of pathways, it's clear that the sooner we act, the less drastic changes will need to be to limit the most damaging consequences of this warming. And although efforts to both reduce and prepare for climate change are already occurring, they must all be scaled up in order to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere and adequately prepare for the changes that we've already committed to. Our window of opportunity for limiting warming continues to narrow. What we choose to do or not over the next 10 to 20 years will determine what our climate future holds for us, for you, for me, for our families, and your constituents. The impacts are here, and the risks and consequences grow with each passing day. Reaching our state's net zero target is imperative to our well-being. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Roop, for that compelling testimony. Representative Akin, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Up next, we have Sasha Lewis-Norell, who is a student from McAllister College.
Ms. Lewis-Norell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Long, and thank you to the committee for allowing me to speak today. My name is Sasha. I'm a college student in St. Paul, and I want to express my support for the Next Generation Climate Act. As a youth climate activist and environmentalist, I and many others constantly experience existential dread about the increasingly catastrophic impacts of the climate crisis. Our futures are in danger, and we must act with appropriate urgency. The science is absolutely clear that we need to significantly reduce our carbon emissions if we are to avoid 2 degrees Celsius of warming or more. We are already seeing the devastating impacts of climate change and the accompanying social impacts. It terrifies me to think how much worse the situation will get if we do not take drastic measures to reduce our emissions. We must follow the science and take the necessary steps to achieve appropriate emission reduction targets. The Next Generation Climate Act builds upon previous legislation with an increased commitment to achieving the necessary emission reduction goals and strengthened environmental justice tenets. It is essential that we fight for and protect communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income communities as we transition to a sustainable economy. Minnesota has a chance to be a bold leader in our country as we fight for a livable future where my generation and generations to follow can thrive. This bill is an important step in creating a livable, sustainable future. Now, more than ever, it is time for bold and powerful action. We must reimagine our future and work tirelessly to create it with our own hands, because time is running out. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Akin, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Up next, we have Dr. Lalitha Sirapanini from the Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate.
Dr. Sirapanini, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long, Vice Chair Ikam, and committee members. My name is Lalitha Sirpaneni. I am an assistant professor and practicing physician in internal medicine with a master's in public health. I am testifying today as a member of Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate. Since this session started, you've heard testimony from several experts now about how climate change is already impacting the health of Minnesotans, and more importantly, how the most vulnerable amongst us who have done the least to cause this damage are unfairly suffering the worst of these impacts. You've also heard that 14 of the 14 medical organizations in Minnesota have declared that climate change is a health emergency and urged you, our legislators, to action. So the bill today is a plan for us to do just that. When patients come into the hospital, one of the things that they're concerned about is, you know, am I getting the right treatment? Am I getting the best treatment? So basically they're thinking, does the medical care I'm getting meet the standard of care? And so throughout our practice and training, whether it's prescribing a lab test or a scan or treatment, we constantly learn to ask ourselves, am I following the most up-to-date evidence and science in making this patient care decision? And this bill reflects that same concept. By adopting the current scientific guidelines from IPCC into policy, you can take climate action that is rooted in the best available science, climate action that benefits public health and the health of your constituents. This is not a new concept for you as Minnesota's legislators. In 2007, bipartisan climate standards were set using what was at that time the best available science, as Vice Chair Akam pointed out. And so now 13 years later, we have so much new data, and now is just simply the time to upgrade those climate standards to reflect the science we have. The second, we cannot manage what we do not measure, and so we need to have reporting standards that are upgraded. Finally, and most importantly, is making sure that our actions now don't cause disproportionate harm to frontline communities. So whenever we take actions to reduce emissions or to sequester carbon, we need to ensure that current and future projects are centered in equity. As you've heard, the science is overwhelmingly clear. The health of every child born today will be impacted by the decisions you all make today, during this session, this year. Climate action that is rooted in science and centered in community justice, now more than ever, can be the foundation to build a clean, healthy, and equitable future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I believe you have one last testifier, Representative Akam.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Next will be Ellen Anderson, who's a climate program director with the Minnesota Center for the Environment.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and Representative Akam and committee members. I'm delighted to be here to speak in support of the Next Generation Climate Act. And just kind of to summarize what we've heard from all the witnesses already today, we know that climate change threatens all of Minnesota now and for future generations. And we know that future generations, just like all of us, deserve a healthy and livable climate. So we've heard compelling testimony about the science, about the health impacts, about why we need to follow the science. And this bill is necessary to get us there. I was at the table in 2007 when we passed the Next Generation Energy Act. And at the time, we followed the current science in 2007. And we did something really visionary by saying that all sectors of the economy have to follow these greenhouse gas reduction goals that are still in law. And when we followed that, the science was correct at the time, but now we have to update the science because we know that our aspirational goals that are indicated in the Next Generation Energy Act are only aspirational. They're not enough. We know that we've only cut emissions 8%, and we should be ready to be near 30% reduction across all sectors of the economy by 2025, according to that law. So amending the Next Generation Energy Act to make it the Next Generation Climate Act is what we must do to meet the challenge that we face. And so just in summary, what the bill does is updates the science and puts current targets into the Next Generation Energy Act, which would now be the Climate Act, that will require a 45% reduction across all sectors of the economy by 2030 and net zero by 2050. It will also put accountability into the law so that government will have to meet this challenge. We can no longer just live with aspirational ideas and goals. And at the same time, this bill allows them flexibility to figure out the best and most efficient way to get there. And finally, we have to prevent disproportionate impacts of additional pollution to environmental justice communities. And this bill does that as well. There was a bipartisan consensus on this bill in 2007. I hope that 14 years later, we can eventually get there, and we need to get there as quickly as possible. So thank you so much. I'd be happy to take any questions or comments.
Thank you so much. Representative Akam, any closing comments before we go to public testimony?
No, I just want to highlight that I believe all members should have been received or as part of the packet materials, letters of support from Center for Energy and the Environment, Fresh Energy, and also the Union for Concerned Scientists.
Thank you, Representative Akam. We have one public testifier signed up, and then we will take member questions. Dr. Christina Dahl, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much. My name is Dr. Christina Dahl. I'm a senior climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you, Chair Long and the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of the Next Generation Energy Act. We are grateful for Representative Akam's leadership on this legislation and for her support of science-based climate policy. As you've already heard this morning, the science is extremely clear. Limiting global warming and its adverse effects requires rapid reductions in heat-trapping emissions now. The 2018 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report made it clear that achieving the Paris Agreement's goals of limiting warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius requires that we as a society reach net zero carbon emissions by around 2050, with about half of those reductions achieved by 2030. UCS supports the updated emission reductions targets that are laid out by the bill, as well as measures to help ensure that the new goals are met. As climate science has advanced, we must realign our climate solutions with the most up-to-date science. The fact that Minnesota is behind on outdated targets is a wake-up call to accelerate emission reductions around the state, not a reason to stray further from the science. So Minnesota should double down on efforts to deploy renewable energy and electrification. As you heard in Dr. Roop's testimony, every fraction of a degree of additional global warming is expected to bring increasingly dramatic changes to the people, economies, and natural resources of Minnesota, on top of those already observed. I co-authored a study called Killer Heat in 2019, in which we examined how extreme heat is likely to change across the US. In Minnesota, there have historically been about 8 days per year on average where the heat index, or feels like temperature, was above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. With no action to steeply reduce emissions, this would increase to 60 days per year on average by century's end. That's 2 months of extreme heat for Minnesota. However, with rapid action to reduce our emissions, the number of days of that level of extreme heat would be limited to 29 days per year on average. So essentially cutting in half the impacts of extreme heat that Minnesota could expect to feel. Just put one more way, meeting the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting warming to 2 degrees Celsius could spare Minnesotans 1 month of exposure to such extreme heat and its associated adverse health impacts each year. Thank you for hearing me out, and I appreciate your efforts with this bill.
Thank you so much. We will now turn to member questions. We have five members who want to ask questions so far, and we'll begin with Representative Franzen.
Mr. Chair, and so this, I'm wondering if I can ask some questions of Dr. Roop.
Go right ahead.
All right, thank you. So my question is, what is the plan to find jobs for all the heavy industrial workers in Representative Hewitt's district, Representative Richardson's district, and Representative Frankie's district, since they make products that will have to be banned under this goal? They can't go to work on the Keystone pipelines because that has been done away with under the current administration. So just kind of wondering where you see those people being transferred to for work.
Representative Akam, did you want to respond first since you're the author?
Yeah, I think so. I appreciate the question, and it's a really good one. And I think that we are working hard in Minnesota to develop a just transition, recognizing that industries are going, we're going to be transitioning away from certain industries. I will also point out that those industries that are growing the most quickly in Minnesota are around green jobs. And so the development of green energy sources like wind and solar. And so I think that the point is a good one. And I think that we all need to work together to make sure that communities can transition from fossil fuel industries to carbon free.
Representative Benson.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Akam, so I'm glad that you mentioned the green energy jobs. Could you tell the body, the committee, where currently then they can sign up for these jobs and how many are available?
Representative?
Mr. Chair. I don't have that information available. And to be fair, this bill is a framework for us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is not, telling any certain industry or any governmental unit how to do that. We're allowing the flexibility of each government unit to work that out on their own. So frankly, that isn't in the jurisdiction of this bill.
Representative,
but it's a good point.
Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, it is very intriguing. Something that we really need to seriously consider here. Do you see, Representative Akam, that individuals that live in these districts will have to leave their families and relocate to find green energy jobs?
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Franzen. I again, don't think that falls within the purview of this bill. This bill is about greenhouse gas reductions. I think we as a state need to work hard to ensure that we are providing transitional opportunities for those industries that we're going away from. And the fossil fuel industry is one of them.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that these are questions that Minnesotans deserve to know if we are moving with these rather robust goals. Before we vote on this and make it into state law, that we should have these answers instead of the, I don't know, we'll just kind of see where the chips fall. Now, Mr. Chair, may I ask another question this time again to...
You can have one more, but we do have four other questioners and we have two other bills.
Okay. So to Ms. Roop from the U, is deindustrialization necessary to achieve these goals? And how will we replace natural gas and propane as reliable direct heating sources? Many people in my district are afraid that they are going to freeze to death. They've been watching what has happened in Texas. Texas has a different climate than what Minnesota has right now. We have some areas in the states negative 50 below this weekend. And so I'm just kind of wondering your thoughts on that.
Dr. Roop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen for that really important question. And I was just reading, of course, the New York Times articles and other articles, all the news coverage of rolling blackouts and thinking how fortunate are we to have systems that are prepared in the state so that we can cope with long duration cold events that we're experiencing that do in fact have of climate connections. And these are really, really critical questions and ones that I think when we look at the science and we look at these pathways that I described to you from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, when we do these scenarios, we're not ignoring the reality of the fact that these are real lives and livelihoods that are dependent upon this energy economy that we have. And none of these pathways are going to put the burden on any sector or single sector or specific fuel type, right? It's a kind of all hands on deck, and we need to iterate through our this transition. We're not going to be able to flip the switch and provide fundamental services that you all are tasked with providing, right? This level of service, a level of infrastructure. And so those critical questions are not being ignored in the science and our modeling, nor in those folks who are looking at generating solutions. If we even look at the energy sector itself, reliability and diversification are central to the work that they've done all along in order to supply us with a reliable energy, for example. And that's not changing as we look to the future. And so it is going to be about adaptability, about being diversified, and thinking about how to march our portfolios forward in an iterative fashion so that the sooner we do that, right, the less drastic those changes have to be. So we have an opportunity now to make these this transition less painful, less dramatic. Surface fewer of those potential risks and exposures that we might get from these needs while balancing, right, this transition. So I think, I guess the summary point is that those are critical points, and those are fundamental to the conversations and the science as it moves forward, as we look towards the feasibility and the imperative of this work, because I think there are also new risks and exposures that we are going to experience from climate impacts. So it's not we're caught in a difficult transition no matter what. And now the difficulty only gets, it's more and more difficult the longer we wait, right? And that's related to jobs and to how your constituents may feel this transition.
Thank you, Dr. Roop. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dr. Roop also. And I try to read experts on both sides of this issue. I'm a layman, but one of the excellent books, and if you email me, I'll send one to you, is Why Scientists Disagree on Global Warming. And the book basically destroys the 97% figure amongst other hoaxes within the global warming movement. But here's my question. There was a petition signed by over 31,000 US scientists, 9,000 with PhDs, and this is what it basically said. There is no convincing scientific evidence that human release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will in the foreseeable future cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere and the disruption of the Earth's climate. Moreover, there is substantial scientific evidence that increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide produce more beneficial effects upon the natural plant and animal environments of the Earth. So my question is, why would 31,000 US scientists, including 9,000 with PhDs, sign a petition like that if everything you said is true?
Dr. Roop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen for that question. So there were several layers of questions there. That 97% figure does stand. In fact, there's an important differentiation. When we think about scientists, there are many of us who identify as scientists, whether you're a medical professional or an engineer. And we all have different subsets of expertise. The author who wrote that paper on the 97% consensus specifically pointed to climate scientists, those who study the physics of Earth's climate system, and who spend and dedicate their careers to really looking at the physics that underlie Earth's climate system, things such as the relationship between CO2 in the atmosphere and temperature, which have a very relatively simple physical equation. In fact, some of my colleagues in physics say we know more about the relationship between temperature and CO2 than we do the laws of gravity. And so that relationship is pretty straightforward, and we understand that relationship quite well. The point in regards to the CO2 and plants, there's no question that certain plants benefit from CO2. Photosynthesis is real and it's critical. However, there is robust science that points to those near-term benefits in things like, say, corn crops, which can produce their own microclimates here in Minnesota. Those benefits of, say, increasing CO2 become outweighed, and negative consequences start to emerge for crops and crop health as we march towards mid-century under a high emissions scenario. So I'd be happy to share further resources with you, but I think the point that other scientists disagree with the expertise, I don't know that you would want someone like myself planning a cancer treatment, because that's not my area of expertise. I could make some guesses about what's appropriate or not, but it'd be inappropriate for me to necessarily comment on the validity of the research. And so again, I'm more than happy to share those resources with you and importantly, where that 97% consensus comes from.
Representative Gruenhagen, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I did. Thank you. Thank you for that response, Dr. Roop. I guess I respectfully disagree with quite a few of your comments. You know, the other question I'd have quickly, AOC, Congress Lady AOC said the Earth is going to end in 12 years. She said that in 2019. We got Prince Charles saying it's going to end in 6 months. And then we got Al Gore saying the U.S. was going to be substantially underwater on our coast in 2013, and that the North and South Pole would be gone. Now, they've been making predictions about this catastrophe since the 1960s. Of course, I'm old enough to remember when we were going to, Time Magazine and others were predicting a catastrophic freezing of the Earth, okay? So, I mean, this just seems to go on and on and on. I just think there should be a consequence when people predict these disasters and nothing happens. I mean, at least 30 days in jail or something like that. But what's your prediction? Is it 96 months? Is it 12 years? When is the world going to end?
Dr. Roop, and then we're going to have to move on. Dr. Roop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, for that follow-up. I don't think any climate scientist is telling you that the world is going to end. And those numbers, that 10-year and that 12-year number, are in fact derived from one of the slides that I've shared in my handouts. And that is the on the current emissions trajectory, we are on target to exceed that 1.5 degree Celsius threshold between 2030 and 2052. The report was published in October of 2018, and that number was picked up and used as a rallying cry for various politicians and climate activists. It's derived on the science, not just mine, but importantly, that of hundreds, if not thousands, of other experts around the globe who are looking at the actual changes that we're seeing in the planet. And so we cannot tell you what will happen on a certain day in a certain year, but we are able to tell you with high confidence the direction of change and the direction of the trends. And we have seen, even since the 1960s, in fact, much of the warmth that we've experienced has happened since the 1950s. We can tell you that the planet is getting warmer, and we are seeing direct impacts related to that warmth in the form of things like flooding, more severe hurricanes. And so the idea that it's not here and not now and not real is against the things that we've actually observed that don't rely on the predictive capacity of a computer model. They are things that we are observing at station data collected in our own state and around with thousands of sensors around the globe.
Yeah, and we agree.
We're going to have to move on. There. Representative Gruenhagen, we have three more questioners and only limited time. Thank you. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testifiers. My question's actually, I'm going to start with Mr. Lewis Norrell to see what his research on campus and a lot of the conversations are about on what we should be doing for responding to the changing climate. One of the concerns that I hear from people, and I've been doing a lot of research on it, is the impact of all the mining that we're doing to produce the products that we're really mandating here in legislation to reduce carbon emission. And I guess my first question is about have your group on at McAllister that does research on renewable energy and such, do you talk about the slavery in the Congo where most of the world's cobalt is mined for the lithium ion batteries that are needed for electric vehicles? And do you support legislation that mandates products that enslave children and many around the world, and especially in China, where they have really human atrocities where they're mining neodymium and graphite in these mines especially? Can you speak to that? Have you guys talked about the human cost?
So noting that I doubt that any of the students at McAllister are experts in end-of-life issues and renewable energy, Mr. Lewis Norrell, if you'd like to respond.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Representative Jerry, Representative Munson. Yeah, I think that, well, first I will start by saying I am absolutely not an expert on all of this. I know that we have to drastically reduce emissions and that there are a number of ways of achieving those emission reduction goals. And that, I think I'll just put it out there, I do not support slavery. I hope that is pretty clear. I do think that we as Minnesotans and as the United States as a whole and as America need to both push for drastic reductions in emissions and also push for humanitarian, solving those humanitarian issues around the world. And we can do that in a number of ways by being leaders, by, working to produce ethical, renewable energy options, as well as a number of other ways that we can reduce emissions. But yeah, I am certainly not an expert on all of that. I will say though that there are definitely a number of ways that we can achieve these emission reduction targets. And the longer that we wait, as was said before, the more our hands will be tied and the more drastic measures we'll need to take.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess for there's so many people that are getting involved in this climate fight, and a lot of the legislation that we're seeing here, especially even this bill on lines 3.16 to 3.19, really talks about the impact to people of color. And it targets only populations within the state of Minnesota that are more than 50% non-white. And so much, I mean, really, I'd say almost entirely, all of the products that we're mandating and subsidizing with taxpayer dollars are mined, processed, and manufactured in developing nations, and of people are almost entirely non-white. And we have to be very cognizant of the damage that we're doing, not only from the human factor, but from the environment. The way that these materials are mined, manufactured, and recycled at their end of their useful life should shock the people that are actively pushing for these products. And we need to include this legislation, this wording in this legislation, to make sure that the state of Minnesota is weighing the cost of slavery. And this isn't just, this is child slavery too. There's an enormous human cost. And I think we need to be cognizant of this damage that we're doing. And it should be part of your conversation on campus. I go to campuses and talk about clean energy, and this is something that we talk about. And this needs to be part of the conversation. So I would encourage you at McAllister to start researching cobalt mining. Because there is no better option out there, and a lot of companies are pushing away from this. Even with, we're not talking about 4-ounce batteries in your cell phones or laptops. We're talking about thousands of pounds of battery that are used in school buses, and we should be teaching our children about the slavery that we're supporting by mandating these products. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak briefly to the point that Representative Franson made about what's happening in Texas. It was also raised by Representative Gruenhagen in an email to the committee earlier today. I want to start by saying that what's happening in Texas is really a tragedy. And of course, the paramount consideration is the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are still without power as we're talking right now in Texas with temperatures far below freezing. But the idea that this tragedy is caused by clean energy or by decarbonization is just dead wrong. It's devoid of any factual basis. And if you're really going to try and politicize a tragedy, I would at least encourage people to get the facts right. So here are the facts. Extreme weather events are bad for energy generation. And it's not just clean energy, all energy. Want proof? In Texas, at the start of this crisis, their grid operator took 12,000 megawatts of wind offline due to the cold. That sounds like a lot. But at the same time, they took 30,000 megawatts of coal, gas, and nuclear offline. A report out today shows that of the total energy lost during this weather event, only 13% came from wind. The cold knocked out more, far more dirty fossil fuel energy than it did clean energy, frozen instruments, frozen coal piles, and natural gas diverted to home heating. These are all factors that impact fossil fuel plants. And you don't have to take my word for it, that both the Texas grid operator and the Republican governor of Texas have both put out public statements to that effect. But this is the wrong argument to be having anyway, because here's the thing, it's well-established science that changing climate is leading to more and more extreme weather events. In my Commerce Committee, the Executive Director of the Insurance Federation, which is hardly a DFL bastion, testified that climate change is fueling extreme weather events that are driving up home insurance premiums right here in Minnesota. How is climate change causing what we're experiencing right now? The warming climate is weakening the jet stream that normally keeps extreme Arctic cold bottled up in the polar regions, and the result is the polar vortex we're hearing more and more about. So extreme weather events are more common due to climate change, and climate change is caused by carbon emissions. So if your thesis is we need more fossil fuel production and carbon emissions so that our energy systems can handle extreme weather, you're missing the boat. One last point I wanted to make. Texas is famous for their deregulated energy sector, and they're also famous for low commercial and industrial energy rates. In fact, I have had large industrial companies in my office, and Republicans in this committee have argued that Minnesota needs to adopt Texas-style energy policy that our industrial companies can more effectively compete. Well, why are our Texas rates lower? Republicans would have you believe it's renewables, but that's preposterous. Wind is the cheapest form of energy, and solar will soon be even cheaper. And Texas has plenty of renewables. The difference is that Texas has a deregulated system, and so their rates favor their industrial customers, where Minnesota regulators prioritize residential consumers. And in addition, Minnesota regulators and utilities are much quicker to invest in grid modernization than they are in Texas. So we have a more robust grid. And on a day like today, I am very, very glad for that. And so I hope my colleagues will remember this the next time we're shown data that our industrial rates are higher in Minnesota than they are in Texas. So this is a great bill, and I encourage everyone to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Representative Hornstein, you'll have the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just a very brief comment. I wanted to thank Representative Akam and the testifiers in support of this bill. I think it's an excellent bill. I strongly support it. You know, we have talked extensively in this committee about other really good bills, Clean Energy First, the 100% renewable bill. But this bill, I think, is particularly important because we're looking at all sectors here. You know, the first two bills I referenced are important because they look a lot at the power and electricity sector. But this looks at all sectors. And I think, you know, when we look at reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you know, I've focused on a number of years on the transportation sector. You know, that is the number one emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, and we've done the least in that sector to reduce emissions. So I wanted to thank, again, the author and the testifiers for a cross-sector approach to looking at addressing this problem and, you know, the particular pieces around transportation, I think, are especially important, Mr. Chair.
Representative Akam, did you want to respond?
Well, I appreciate that comment, Representative Hornstein, and I just appreciate the conversation this morning, the testimony brought forward by our experts. And I think what we all know is we want Minnesota to be a great place for us to live and raise our families and for all of us to thrive. And so in order to do that, the science is telling us that we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so that's what we need to work together to do. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Akam, and thank you to our testifiers today. Next, we have up a bill from Representative Hollins on intervener compensation. Representative Hollins, would you care to present your bill?
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard on this and very important bill. This is the Intervenor Compensation Bill, and it's a bill to compensate public interest organizations that participate in Public Utility Commission's PUC proceedings. The bill builds upon the recognition that public interest organizations that participate in utility rate cases are entitled to compensation when they materially contribute to the case record and to the commission's decisions in those cases. What this bill does is it recognizes that more and more commission decisions are made regarding energy policies and practices outside of the infrequent utility rate cases. It's an increasing trend, and it's why the statute really needs to be updated now. In order to qualify for compensation under the provisions of this bill, nonprofits, tribes, and individuals that promote a public interest must meet stringent standards. They have to fully engage in any proceeding. They have to offer a unique position and perspective, and the commission must adopt a position advocated by the participant. So the bill limits the amount of compensation in three different ways. One is by capping the amount that any one participant can receive in any given year. Next is by capping the amount that any organization could receive in a given PUC docket. And the third is by capping the amount that a utility company is expected to contribute for that compensation. Current statute includes compensation for organizations that participate in rate cases. This bill expands the opportunity for representation of public interest organizations to participate in additional PUC proceedings. It promotes equitable access to the PUC, and that access is really necessary to ensure that the commission considers a range of expertise, experiences, and perspectives. The principle for this bill is based on the recognition that organizations contribute to judicious PUC determinations in a wide range of proceedings. It addresses the current imbalance between utility companies' ability to represent their interests and the ability of public interest advocates to represent their constituencies. And I recognize that this is maybe a little bit of a technical subject, and I know that there has been a lot of back and forth between the CUB and Energy Sense with the regulated utilities and other groups and stakeholders to reach a really workable update to the law. I know that the decisions are ongoing to work out a couple of different remaining issues, and one of our testifiers, Annie, will talk more about that. I do have four testifiers today. It's Annie Levinson-Falk from Citizens United Board of Minnesota, Pam Marshall, Energy Sense Coalition, Tina Kocher from Minnesota Power, and Robert Blake from Native Sun Community Power Development. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to hand it over to the testifiers to get into the weeds a little bit more.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. We'll begin with Ms. Levinson-Falk. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Levinson-Falk, I can't hear you.
My apologies, I was double muted. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk, and I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, or CUB, a nonprofit advocate for residential and small business utility consumers. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this bill today. CUB has worked with Representative Hollins and the Energy Sense Coalition, who you'll hear from next, to bring forward this bill in order to update the intervener compensation statute and current law. The Public Utilities Commission's job is to balance many priorities to ensure that electricity and natural gas service is affordable, reliable, complies with the state's environmental and other laws, and allows utility companies the opportunity to earn revenues and a fair rate of return. Because of its quasi-judicial nature, the PUC must only consider the evidence and arguments on the record before it in any proceeding. That means the commissioners depend on parties to bring evidence in each proceeding that's representative of the variety of interests that they need to weigh. However, it's quite difficult to participate at the PUC, especially to do so well. It often takes hours of research, writing formal legal filings, and coordinating and negotiating with utilities and other parties. Many important issues require knowledge of very technical topics for which parties must hire outside experts. And it's helpful to have the kind of understanding of the process and precedent that can only be gained from years of experience in the venue. This kind of rigorous record building is what allows the PUC to make informed decisions on very complex questions. However, it's extremely difficult for nonprofits and public interest organizations to keep up. At the same time, as Representative Hollins said, the number and scope of proceedings at the PUC has increased dramatically. General rate cases are certainly still very important, but they only happen periodically. For example, Xcel last went through an electric rate case 6 years ago, and Minnesota Power had no rate cases between 2009 and 2016. Rates still increase between rate cases, of course, but that happens in other types of proceedings. You also have proceedings related to shutoff practices, decisions to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in new power plants, new meters, or other infrastructure, customer service standards, and many other types of dockets. While the utility companies recover their cost of participating at the PUC from ratepayers, there's currently no similar mechanism for non-governmental organizations who represent public interests aside from in rate cases. The result is that too often the PUC has to make important decisions with records that do not reflect all of the perspectives that commissioners need to have taken into account. The legislature created the intervener compensation to address the need for robust representation at the PUC so that the commission has what it needs to do its job. After 14 years, the statute's now in need of an update. Representative Hollins walked through what the bill does, so I won't repeat any of those details. However, I do want to share that, as she said, the discussions are ongoing with the utilities, the Department of Commerce, and industrial customers to address some concerns with the current language. And we believe that with some adjustments, the bill will be able to move forward with consensus support. Some of the areas that are under discussion for changes include reducing the maximum amount of compensation a utility may be required to pay, and further ensuring that compensation is only granted for participation that advances the public interest. Thank you very much for your consideration of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you so much. Next, we'll hear from Ms. Marshall. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Pam Marshall, and I've directed the Energy Sense Coalition for the past 29 years. Our organization promotes affordable utility service for low and fixed income Minnesotans. My testimony today will focus on just a few of the examples of the PUC proceedings in which Energy Sense has participated and a brief description of the results of that engagement. Our organization has been involved in a number of negotiated and commission-approved settlements that produced a range of results from targeting utility refunds to low-income customers to the implementation of the first low-income energy conservation program dedicated specifically to renters in 1-4 unit buildings. The commission has also approved our recommendations for utility bill payment programs that supplement the federal energy assistance program, place people on affordable payment plans and protect them from service disconnection. And combined, these programs serve about 45,000 Minnesota households each year. Although the commission has limited jurisdiction over rural electric and municipal utilities, Energy Sense did lead an effort to investigate questionable service practices of Beltrami Electric Co-op, particularly as those practices affected the members of the Red Lake Nation. In that case, the commission ordered the co-op to refund with interest any payments that they held and any payments that they had required tribal members to pay the past due bills of a landlord or of relatives with whom they did not even reside. At the time, the co-op actually conditioned the connection of electric service on those illegal requests for payment. In addition to several other actions in that case required by the commission, the co-op was also ordered to refund members' security deposits that they had held indefinitely. Currently, Energy Sense is working with the utility companies and the commission to track the impacts of the pandemic on customers' ability to pay their bills. The commission accepted our recommendations to standardize reporting both during and after the pandemic, to track the number of past due customers, the amounts they owe, service disconnections and reconnections, and other indicators and performance benchmarks. We're also working to ensure that customers can maintain service once the current disconnection moratorium is lifted. While I can't offer a description of our involvement in all of the PUC proceedings, I did want to convey that that involvement has leveraged millions of dollars that directly benefit low and fixed income Minnesotans. These outcomes would have been unlikely without our participation, but we do have to choose which proceedings to be involved in, and we also have to decline to do so in many instances because of limited resources and capacity. We think this bill takes an important step toward helping us to continue and to expand our participation and our ability to appear before the commission on behalf of low-income energy consumers. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Next, we'll hear from Ms. Kager. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm Tina Kager, Manager of Customer Experience Operations at Minnesota Power. We're an investor-owned electric utility serving 145,000 customers and operating in 26,000 square miles in beautiful northeastern Minnesota. We are the first utility in Minnesota to deliver 50% renewable energy to its customers. And just as we've seen significant changes in our energy mix, we also acknowledge significant changes in the quantity and frequency of regulatory filings that are consequential for our customers and communities. An important part of the regulatory filing process is public participation and the perspective shared in that process. As such, Minnesota Power has been engaged in constructive dialogue with parties on the topic of intervener compensation, as currently provided for under Minnesota Statute 216B.16, Subdivision 10. In general, we support extended public participation, agree with a measured approach to update existing intervener compensation definitions and provisions in statute, and value diverse perspectives and input in public proceedings. Importantly, drafts discussed to date seek to provide intentional clarity around participants eligible for compensation, material assistance, and unique contributions, and a tie to public purpose or policy. Further foundational principles discussed in determining the maximum compensation amounts include consideration of a utility's size, potential cost impacts for utilities and their customers, and current cost recovery. This has led to the inclusion of important limitations, or what may be referred to as guardrails, as it pertains to the magnitude of these costs at both the proceeding and total annual compensation levels. There's also recognition that complexity of proceedings can vary, and as such, compensation for a single proceeding is also included as part of this change. While there are details and outstanding issues to finalize in the draft proposal, we appreciate the thoughtful approach to date and will continue working with parties toward a final proposal to update intervener compensation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And our final testifier from Representative Hollins is Mr. Blake. Welcome back to the committee.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for having me. Anim Buju Miigwech. My name is Robert Blake. I am the Executive Director of Native Sun Community Power Development. I'm also a Red Lake Tribal Band member. And this bill would really help tremendously, especially with individuals from BIPOC communities to participate in this process. I know for a fact that, you know, that a lot of us are unable to participate in this process because we don't have the resources to do so. And with this bill, this would allow us to be a part of this process, especially with the extreme weather events that we are going to be seeing, the upgrades that we're going to need to our energy system, and all the other policies that go along with that. We've never really had the opportunity to participate in stuff, in especially in bills like this, but now we're able to do so. And this bill would really tremendously help us out a lot. So especially when we look at the disparities between Black and white in the state of Minnesota, I also feel like this bill also will help alleviate and bridge some of those gaps. So thank you very much, Chairman Long, for having me. And I appreciate and we'll answer any questions after this.
Thank you so much. We had one public testifier sign up, and we will turn to that now. Mr. Rick Evans, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I really can make this very short. We adopt the comments that Minnesota Power made in their testimony. We are looking forward to working with the author as well as the other advocates to clear up some of the continuing questions we have. Our questions focus primarily on right-sizing the program. Since our customers are paying for this, we want to make sure that they're getting what they're paying for, and also making sure that the additional compensation is targeted towards people who, you know, will increase their participation as a result of this bill. I think we're very close to accomplishing that in our discussions and look forward to continuing them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. I don't see questions. Representative Hollins, would you like to make some concluding remarks?
I just want to thank all of the testifiers. Oh, I see a hand.
Okay, we do have a question. Representative Franzen.
I see two hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Hollins, I am wondering if this bill would allow groups that employ registered lobbyists to get reimbursed for their PUC costs.
Representative Hollins.
I'm going to defer to the expertise from my testifiers from the CUB.
Ms. Levinson-Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Franzen, yes, it would. And in fact, to participate in a rate case before the Public Utilities Commission, you're actually required to register as a lobbyist. So if we barred lobbyists from intervener compensation, it would undermine the purpose actually of the current statute.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then who pays for the reimbursement? Would it be the utility or the customers?
Is that to Ms. Levinson-Fock or to?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Levinson-Fock.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franson, it would be the utility, but ultimately all of the utilities money comes from the customers, which is something that both Cub and Energy Sense are very familiar with. So when we put the bill together, that was one of our primary concerns, is to make sure that the cost of it, even at the most extreme, you know, maximum situation, wouldn't be any kind of a burden to customers. So we have estimates of the amounts that are written in the law. First of all, there's quite a few screens that make it very unlikely that a utility would get to its maximum, but say that it did, we're still talking about at the very most a couple of cents a month for a residential customer. But as we've discussed, we're in discussions to probably reduce that even further. And I think the primary concern there is to make sure that it's not going to be a noticeable cost to customers at any point.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, what I'm hearing is that this bill is going, even you say it's a couple of cents, but we know once reality hits, a couple of cents turns into much more cents than just a couple. But that this bill actually makes it more expensive for constituents, our constituents, my constituents, your constituents, to pay more for electric and gas in order to pay lobbyists to argue for more expensive electric and natural gas bills. And lobbyists are registered to lobby at the legislature too, but I'm very concerned that we are going to be increasing electrical costs and we are all going to have constituents that are going to be paying for lobbyists to, you know, argue for more expensive methods of heating our homes with electric and natural gas. So just something to put out there.
Ms. Marshall looked like she wanted to chime in.
Thank you, Chair Long and Representative Franson. I think it's all important to take note that the bill does limit the organizations that can receive this compensation to tribes and nonprofits and individuals without a business self financial interest in the outcome of any proceeding. Also, to the issue of the few cents a month growing, the bill actually limits it caps the amount of money that would be available each year. So it doesn't increase with the number of participating organizations. And the other thing I would say is, you know, there is a lot of resources dedicated to participating in front of the commission. Many of the times it is not an adversarial utility company versus consumer advocate type of situation, but is instead a stakeholder process that ends up in a consensus that balances the interests of affordability and efficiency and other policies. And we think that's more and more true with the types of organizations that were considered to participate under this bill.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. Thank you so much for this bill. I strongly support it. And I think to the conversation that we're having, I want to emphasize what Ms. Marshall said. This legislation reminds me of the Superfund law that was passed at the federal level. The EPA actually has technical assistance grants for community groups and nonprofits. It's called the TAG, the TAG program. And they, you know, they recognize that a lot of people do not have the expertise, and these are very technical issues. And so, in fact, this levels the playing field and allows more people to participate. And in fact, some of these interventions, you know, have resulted in lower rates. So I think for that reason, this bill is very worthy of our support. And again, there is precedent in a number of different sectors. The EPA Superfund TAG program is not identical to this, but of course the concept is the same.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Lee, and then we're gonna have to move to our final bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll keep it short. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this forward and for the testifiers too. It is like what Representative Hornstein said and what we have heard, that this is for protecting some of our most vulnerable Minnesotans in the state. And I think that this is a good step forward, because we do note that systematically, you know, when our residents, some of the most vulnerable, the low-income Minnesotans who are appearing before the PUC does not have the capacity to really engage in that process. And so many thanks to you, Representative Hollis, and the chair for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And I'll just note that utilities have registered lobbyists too, and those registered lobbyists are also reimbursed by ratepayers. Thank you so much, Representative Hollins, for bringing this bill forward. This is really important work, and thank you to all of the stakeholders for working to find common ground to move forward. Next, we are hearing our final bill, which is Representative Lippert's bill on distributed energy resources. Representative Lippert, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I've been hearing from constituents who want to install a solar array, and as they start making investments and their projects underway, they then receive communication from Xcel Energy that the homeowner is responsible or the business owner is responsible for upgrades that are necessary for interconnection to the grid. The fees are often $8,000. One person in Northfield was told the charge would be $16,000, and that was a deal breaker for that homeowner in that particular project. This bill requires the Public Utilities Commission to develop incentives for utilities to invest in infrastructure upgrades that will allow for the interconnection of distributed energy resources. We think this is a win-win scenario for utilities and for customers who want to be installing solar or wind. Distributed generation enhances a utility's ability to ensure peak demand is met reliably and efficiently. And customers reduce their overall demand by being supplied with on-site generation and will only draw from the grid what their system doesn't cover. For communities like those I represent, Northfield, Lonsdale, Montgomery, and other greater Minnesota communities, a solution like this is necessary. Otherwise, we're placing the burden for upgrading the grid on the shoulders of homeowners and business owners that are doing exactly what we want them to do, leading the way, and encouraging others to install renewable energy too. This is an unfair cost, and it will slow the adoption of the renewable energy that we so desperately need. So at this time, I'll turn to my first testifier, Mr. David Schaefer.
Mr. Schaefer, welcome to the committee.
Thanks for having me. Chair Long and members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee, my name is David Schaefer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, or MNSEIA. We represent 115 different solar energy companies and other solar-related businesses that employ roughly 4,200 Minnesotans. Thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak today, and I want to thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bill forward today to be heard. This bill, titled Promoting Distributed Energy Resources Interconnections, is critical to the advancement of distributed energy resources around the state. Currently, customer access to distributed energy is dependent in part on how much the utility has invested in their own distribution system. This bill helps to remedy that issue. Some places where the utility has forecasted load growth, like the metro area, have ample opportunity for customers to go solar, put in their own combined heat and power plant, or put up a small wind turbine. Other places where load growth is leveling or declining have poorer distribution system equipment, causing upgrades and putting people in outstate Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage. If you couple the limited capacity available in those parts of the state with the rapid onset of distributed energy resources on farmland, the distribution system congestion becomes problematic for other new customers looking to install their own DERs, or distributed energy resources. There simply isn't enough capacity available, and there's no reasonable means to fix the problem when the next person in line has exorbitant upgrade costs they are facing for rather small systems. Today, you will hear from a few individuals who live in Northfield, which is one of the places that is facing this issue today. We have member companies that have pulled back altogether from selling solar in that area because the interconnection costs are too high and customers are routinely disappointed. I've heard prices ranging from $8,000 to $16,000, as Representative Lippert said, and that's fairly common for grid infrastructure improvements that Northfield customers have to pay before they can install even a small rooftop array. For reference, the solar array at my house is $14,000 total, so these interconnection costs are a huge increase in terms of the percentage of the total project cost. Northfield, however, is one of the first places to feel this challenge, but unless this bill is passed and some other solutions are implemented, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be the last place that we see this crop up anytime soon. Without this bill, many outstate Minnesotans will be unable to generate their own electricity. They'll be subject to the constraints of the system and those that regulate it. I've even heard a few customers that can't put up no export systems because the utilities are relying on their existing load to balance the system. These problems need fixing before they become common. This bill does not require utilities to invest in their distribution system proactively to ensure that customers always have the ability to interconnect. It is not a mandate, but it encourages the utility to do so. It is a carrot to persuade proactive investment in utility-owned equipment. The bill gives Xcel Energy, Minnesota Power, and Otter Tail Power the ability to be good stewards of their own distribution system equipment and to provide quality service to every Minnesotan that is looking to have some control over their own energy future. This bill, in its present form, gives the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission significant leeway to determine what incentives are sufficiently motivating for the various investor-owned utilities. But we're excited to work with the bill author and other interested parties to refine this bill to make sure that it accomplishes its aim to allow any customer to interconnect to the utility without exorbitant costs for a transformer upgrade or something similar. With that, I'm happy to conclude, and I'll pass it over to the other speakers that are here today, and I'm available for questions. Thank you all for your time, and we really hope that you consider this bill in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lippert, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Howard White is here, and he is prepared to testify. Howard.
Mr. White, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and I thank the committee for receiving my testimony. I've had a rooftop solar array since 2015, and I'm very pleased with it. It was my desire to add solar-generated power to the electric grid instead of just making use of a community solar garden. I purchased an all-electric vehicle just 16 months ago, increased my electricity consumption, and I wanted to increase my solar array to generate more. I received a bid of $21,000 in April 2020. Federal tax credits and Xcel solar rewards enabled my net cost to be only $11,000, and that was affordable for my wife and me. Our solar installation provider, All Energy Solar, worked with Xcel to do the necessary engineering. I borrowed the money that would be needed for the installation and was excited to get the project completed. In the first analysis by Xcel, we learned that our proposed solar array needed to be downsized from 16 new panels to 11. I was okay with that. It would lower my net cost to about $7,000, but Xcel indicated that they needed to do a supplemental review. In August, I learned that supplemental review showed the need for a distribution upgrade, and the cost of that would be borne by me, the customer. The cost was going to be $8,000. That doubled the net cost to me, and it was too much to bear. I have installed my own rooftop solar because I want to increase the production of fossil-free electricity. There are incentives in place, but the distribution upgrade was a huge and disappointing surprise to me. Since the upgrade would be owned by Xcel and not me, as I understand it, I think they should bear the cost for it instead of the homeowner, or at least have it shared by all ratepayers. Having a policy change at the state level to enable that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. White, for joining us. Representative Lippert, did you have another testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Beth Kallestad is with us as well.
Ms. Kallestad, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. My name is Beth Kallestad, and I work for the City of Northfield, providing project management for our Climate Action Plan. The City of Northfield adopted our Climate Action Plan in November 2019 with two ambitious goals. The first was to receive 100% carbon-free electricity by 2030, and the second is to be carbon-free by 2040. To reach these goals, one of the strategies we're pursuing is to increase the amount of inbound renewable energy which is generated with the hope of achieving 20 megawatts by 2040. To do this, we need a significant increase in on-site solar from residents and businesses. As we've begun work on this effort, I've been contacted by several residents who have experienced these cost causer events that we've been discussing. This means that when they've worked to install the solar with Xcel and their provider, they've been given these distribution system upgrades that they would need to pay for. And the current practice for the PUC distributed energy resource interconnection process, as you've heard, is for the interconnection customer to pay for that cost. And these can be very high and can result in on-site solar being abandoned in some situations. The existing process is a disincentive and in many cases may make it prohibitive for residents and small businesses to install much needed on-site solar. Increasing the amount of on-site solar will allow the city of Northfield and the state of Minnesota to make progress on our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. It will also make us more resilient to climate-related weather issues as we'll have more capacity to generate power locally. I wish to thank Representative Lippert for his efforts to offer a solution to this situation and to this committee for being willing to consider the issue.
Thank you so much. We had one public testifier sign up. Mr. Rick Evans, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Lippert has brought up a really more complicated and profound discussion than you may possibly know. And I look forward, the company looks forward to working with him and the proponents in this bill as we start thinking about this difficult subject. For those that may not know, when we talk about a distribution grid, we're talking about the smaller wires and poles that deliver energy from our transmission system into your neighborhoods to provide energy to your homes and businesses. This is the system that the solar panels would be interconnected with. Like all of our facilities, the distribution system is subject to strict regulation by the Public Utilities Commission. We do 5-year planning documents on the upgrades provided to the system. We also, of course, are not able to recover the cost of any investment in the distribution system unless we can show the Public Utilities Commission that it is prudent and in the best interests of our customers. This is a very large system over a large area, and we spend a lot of time, as does the PUC and the Department of Commerce, as well as other stakeholders, in planning and investing in the distribution system. The goal of that system has traditionally really always been to provide prudent investments for the benefit of all of our customers, paid for by all of our customers in a fair and equitable way. The focus of this bill changes investments in the distribution system in a way that would be profound. Instead of focusing on the benefits for the entire system and the benefits for all of our customers, it would encourage investments that serve a narrow band of customers, a narrow band of interests, including the solar installers and customers who are looking to install solar energy on their homes. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it's important that you understand what you're doing. You will essentially be changing the investment in the distribution grid to provide benefits to a small slice of customers, with the cost being borne by all customers across the system. While in the traditional model, the regulators of the state can measure the benefits of the investments versus the costs for the customer, for all of our customers, this bill will require the PUC to measure the benefits for a small group of customers and how those benefits should be weighed when charging all of our customers. That's going to be a change in the standard, and we need to think about how the PUC is going to be making those decisions. So this bill presents some real challenges to the traditional way that in Minnesota we have regulated public utilities for the benefit of all customers, with fair and equitable pricing for all customers. So we look forward to having these discussions with Representative Lippert and the proponents and to see if there's some way that we can manage the situation that is consistent with the best interests of all of our customers. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. I see we do have two member questions. We have about 5 minutes left. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lippert, is there a prohibition in the bill on subsidizing solar panels made with Chinese slave labor?
Representative Lippert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I don't believe that there's any language in the bill that's dealing with that issue that's outside the purview of this bill.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't you think it behooves the committee to make sure that we are, if this is the route that we're going to go to, that this country, that this state is not profiting off of the back of human capital, off of slave labor? This is a major human rights issue.
Is that a rhetorical question, or did you want that directed to?
No, I'm directing it to Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen. I think those of us on this side of the aisle are very concerned about averting an environmental crisis. We want to give our children and grandchildren a livable planet. We're very concerned about our children's future and the children of the world. And so I think that's a conversation we're very interested in engaging in. And I look forward to talking more about the life cycle of renewables, and we're going to be having cleaner and cleaner renewables as we go forward. But we're talking about averting an environmental crisis here, and we need to be serious about that.
Representative Franzen, last question, then we have two more before we wrap.
Certainly. Well, there are children in China that are being forced to further these green energies, and their lives matter as well as diverting this crisis that you talk about. I mean, there is a crisis, a human rights crisis that is taking place so that first world countries can achieve a green energy utopia. Now, my question is, back to the bill that you are carrying, Representative Lippert, why should working families in my district pay more for their electricity so that wealthy people can put solar on their roof?
A question on the bill. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen. I think, I appreciate Mr. Evans' testimony as well, and look forward to working with him on the language of the bill. I think a grid that's able to absorb distributed energy is good for all of us. And when we're addressing the climate crisis, we're going to be addressing the needs of the poorest as well, because the climate crisis is already affecting the poorest in our country and around the world in disproportionate ways. And so focusing on the climate crisis is good for all of us.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I find myself in agreement with Mr. Evans' testimony regarding this bill. I think, number one, it's discriminatory. It favors a few people who are doing what the bill wants them to do, and it discriminates against other ratepayers. And that never produces good results in the long run. But my point is this, is that the more government subsidy we provide to things, including this, the higher the price goes. If we allow the free market to work, the price will come down. We've got evidence of that all over in our society. But as soon as government subsidies show up, whether healthcare, roads and bridges, or this, the price never comes down. It always keeps going up. So when you provide more subsidy, I guarantee you that within a few years, the price will more than double. And then they'll be back here wanting more subsidy, okay? It's just a vicious cycle of socialism. And since we're running out of time, I just want to make that statement. Thank you. If Mr. Lippert wants to respond, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen. I hear your appeal to the heart of the market and the heart of capitalism. I guess I don't have the same confidence in it. I think we as people can work together and choose and make choices about the frame that the market's going to operate in so that we can meet our shared challenges like the climate crisis. And I think that's what this bill is about.
Representative Swazinski.
Just a question on, so if the utilities can be required to pay the interconnection costs. Is there a size in the bill? I don't have the bill right in front of me this very second, like how large generating capacity has to be or to limit whether or not the other utility players, people have to pay for it.
Representative Lippert, briefly, and then we'll have to wrap up.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Long. I'll defer to Mr. Schaefer to talk about how these incentives would work.
Mr. Schaefer.
So the bill references the distributed energy resources language, which is 10 megawatts. I think you know, depending on how people feel about it, we could keep it to on-site generation or residential or whatever. I think the language as it's written to me suggests it's intended for just a conversation at this moment in time, on the size at least.
So Mr. Chair, my understanding is that briefly, yeah. Would solar gardens qualify under this current bill?
Mr. Schaefer?
At the moment, yes.
I see Mr. Elop has his hand up. Maybe he wants to add something to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention this must be structured to increase as the aggregate capacity of distributed energy resources whose interconnection is enabled by the investment increases. So in response to Representative Swiecinski's question, there is a, the bigger the change to allow more solar, the larger the incentives are allowed to be under the bill.
So we are, thank you, Mr. Elop. We are out of time. Representative Lippert, did you want to make a closing comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate the time of the committee. I recognize this is walking into a profound conversation, and I look forward to working more with XL Energy around it.
Thank you so much, Representative Lippert. Thank you all very much. Our next meeting is this Thursday, February 18th at 10:30 a.m., and this remote meeting is adjourned.